From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
It's long been a goal of our space program, sending a human to Mars. But traveling to Mars would require a 250-day flight. Could a group of astronauts tolerate that journey without major complications?
NASA has asked Mayo Clinic to study ways to help humans travel to Mars, including the idea of human hibernation.
I think they'll make it. I'm excited. I'm completely, totally sold on this. Because in my lifetime, I'm going to see somebody, a fellow human, land on Mars. That's just incredible.
Also on the program, vitamin D is important to bone health, but does it play a role in disease prevention?
And healthy summer grilling hacks.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Since Yuri Gagarin, was that before you were born?
I think so,
that guy who took the first manned space flight in April of 1961. It was before you were born.
Yes, right? It was.
Humans have been fascinated by space travel. Neil Armstrong, remember he walked on the moon in July of 1969? Were you alive for that one?
Yes.
Yes, you were. And since then, space programs have been looking to the next frontier. And believe it or not, you know what that is? Humans going to Mars.
Wow.
But a trip to the red planet will indeed present problems for the astronauts, not the least of which is how long it takes to get there.
Mayo Clinic has been asked to study whether medically induced hypothermia, human hibernation, might help astronauts to endure the medical and logistical rigors of a journey that NASA hopes to launch less than two decades from now. Here to discuss is Mayo Clinic anesthesiologist, Dr. Matthew Kumar. Dr. Kumar, it is great to meet you and welcome to the program.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
It seems like you're excited to be here, but in fact, you're excited to be anywhere, aren't you? So tell us about your recent trip to India.
Oh, Tom, you know, I've been going to India for the past 40 years. Every year I go, I take a bottle of DEET with me. You know, the mosquitoes
keep the bugs
are a major
off,
problem.
Yeah.
This year, I got too overconfident that nothing is going to happen to me, and I didn't take a bottle of DEET. And I got bit by mosquitoes, real bad, big mosquitoes. And I ended up getting dengue hemorrhagic fever.
We don't see that in the U.S.
or
maybe
movies.
A case in Hawaii. Yeah, so tell us what happened. I mean, and I know it wasn't good. But you survived.
Yes, I barely survived. So, you know, I was bleeding internally. It was encephalitis, so it's a high fever. So I was delirious for 4 days.
Encephalitis meaning inflammation of the lining of the brain.
Inflammation of the brain and the linings of the brain. Totally delirious.
And viral, so there's nothing you could do. Just bear it.
Just bear it. And, you know, it's a symptomatic treatment. They don't have an antibiotic that they can use. They don't have a vaccine. You know, it's God's grace that you survive.
Really?
You don't.
So what percentage of people who get, is it dengue? Is that how you pronounce
yes,
it?
Yes, D-E-N-G-U-E, yeah. Dengue. Dengue fever
dengue,
or dengue fever.
Okay. How many, what percentage survive?
How
lucky are you?
you know, the mortality is somewhere between 35% and 40%.
Really?
Yes, yes. If you have end organ failure, then it puts you, the mortality goes up to 60% to 70%. If, you know, what I had, the renal failure along with encephalitis, and I also had viral endocarditis.
So that's the lining of the heart.
Yes.
And you weren't here at Mayo Clinic. You were in India.
I was not saying
that you weren't safe there, but I would bet you might have thought, I wish I was at home.
Oh, absolutely. You know, airlines wouldn't let me fly because they were afraid I was going to die in flight.
Oh, my gosh.
Really?
Yes.
And now, how long does this last? And how did they treat it?
Remember, this is not about dengue fever.
I know. We'll get to Mars here shortly, but I got to hear about this. I mean, this is horrible.
They put me in an ICU, and you know, there is no treatment other than just symptomatically giving me IV fluids and some food. And eventually, you know, your body recovers, and you know, your immune system fights it back.
Finally, huh?
Yes, it took me 2 weeks.
Well, I only know because last year, Dr. Tosh told me in an interview, I think when you were gone, that there was some dengue fever in Hawaii and in the southeastern part of the United States. So it actually is not just in India, it is closer to home as well.
I was surprised to know that. You know, yeah. I did a little bit of research on dengue fever once I had the fever.
Can you get it twice?
I think you could, but you know, you had developed active immunity, so
well,
you know,
I would think so.
You know,
he's never
going
to travel without DEET
no,
again.
No kidding.
And
spray
you know
that
what?
On.
If you go to Mars, do you think that you need to take DEET with you? Is that something to be concerned about?
I think I
about?
Would.
Well, tell us about how you got interested in this. I mean, you're an anesthesiologist.
Yes.
But yet you're talking about Mars. So how are you involved with this?
Well, you know, one of my research aspects is therapeutic hypothermia, you know, lowering the body temperature as a therapeutic modality for treating cardiac arrest or for patients with stroke or with somebody.
So stroke or heart attack, you're lowering the body temperature because the survival is better?
Survival is much better. You protect the neurons, you know, once your metabolic rate goes down.
Neurons, that's like the brain.
Yes.
Yeah. You remember, I'm a bone doctor, and we're talking to the lay public here.
Okay.
It's got enormous neuroprotective effects, hypothermia, just dropping the body temperature by about 5 to 6 degrees centigrade. You know, you achieve pretty good neuronal protection. There is nothing out there that can do that. You know, if you completely cool the body down to about 16 or 18 degrees C, you can stop the heart for about an hour, you know, circulatory arrest for about an hour. So, you know, hypothermia is a very effective neuroprotectant. That's the one thing that
brain,
we know for
neuro.
Sure.
You, for when you say neuro, protection. You mean brain. Okay.
Yes. So my interest, my basic scientific curiosity is more in terms of therapeutic hypothermia. You know, we have been studying therapeutic hypothermia in pigs following traumatic brain injury for the past 5 or 6 years, and then prior to that in humans, you know, observing how what happens with hypothermia. So when we got called, you know, by some of the co-investigators, they wanted to see if we can induce hibernation, which is very similar to therapeutic hypothermia, in astronauts who are traveling to Mars, you know. So it kind of dovetails nicely, therapeutic hypothermia and hibernation. Because if you look at a bear, it's a hibernating bear. It's very similar to therapeutic hypothermia. You know, the body temperature drops down to about 30 C or 32 C, and the heart rate goes down, and respirations go down, and the animal sleeps for about 6 months without eating or peeing, you know, or urinating. And
hypothermia, I'm not a medical doctor here, but I just know that it's not good. So is it specifically very carefully managing the hypothermia that makes it okay to even have this conversation?
Correct.
Okay.
It's not just accidental hypothermia could be dangerous, obviously.
Sure.
But, you know, controlled hypothermia, therapeutic hypothermia, you know, controlling it and keeping it in a narrow range of somewhere between 28 C and 32 C seems to have all the beneficial effects without the deleterious effects of hypothermia. If your core body temperature drops below 28, you start having cardiac arrhythmias, which could kill you. So you really don't want your core body temperature to drop below 28. So you keep it in that narrow range. You achieve the benefits without the side effects.
So the idea is if you can get the astronauts to hibernate or you get them hypothermic, they'll be easier. It'll be better for them, easier for them to make the trip?
Yes. You know, we at least one of the hypothesis that we are proposing is, you know, put them in hibernation, not for the entire trip, but maybe part of the trip. You know, you cycle them. You know, there are 9 astronauts. They go to sleep for 3 weeks, then they wake up, and then the next crew goes into hibernation torpor, and then you wake them up after 3 weeks, and so we kind of cycle them.
You can do that?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
What about through January, February,
weeks that
and
I'd
March?
Like to miss. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Okay, so you're working in collaboration with NASA. Are they excited about the work that you're doing?
They are. They are excited, and we are totally excited. You know, we got some great team working on this. You know, I got Dr. Kelly Drew from Alaska, Oyvind Toyn from Alaska to Center for Arctic Studies. So it's just a phenomenal group of people, and I got Dr. Alexander Rabenstein here from Mayo, a neurologist. So we got a great team, and we are looking at it. And I think we believe it's almost necessary. You know, if you're going to travel for 253 days to reach Mars, it's going to be a lot difficult to stay in a confined small capsule with 9 other people.
Yeah, interesting. Dr. Matthew Kumar, he's an anesthesiologist at the Mayo Clinic, and he's also an expert on human hibernation, and we got to hear more about this. And when we come back, we'll ask him, you know, how far is it to Mars? I guess he said it takes 253 days to get there, and why would anybody want to go? Time for a short break.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
We are with anesthesiologist Dr. Matthew Kumar, a survivor of dengue fever, and now working. I'm still amazed about that. 35-40% of people die if they get this disease.
That's correct.
This is a very confusing conversation. Yeah. Dengue fever
and
hibernation.
But how can you just not talk about that? Maybe you ought to just stay home next year.
Pray to the good Lord.
That's good. All right, so when it comes to sending humans to Mars, it's over 250 days to do so, and it's boring, I guess, a long ways to go. And what would be the benefit of hibernating, aside from you get a lot of reading done or watch a lot of movies? What's the benefit of having those astronauts in hibernation instead of just sitting for 250 days?
Tracy, great question. Hibernation has got two components. One is the observable thing, that's sleep. You know, they're sleeping. They're not awake. And the second is the hypothermia, you know, lowering the body temperature. The sleep has a couple of benefits here. One is it immobilizes the astronaut, so they're confined in a pod, hibernation pod, where they're sleeping. So it right away negates the need for activities of daily living. That's like, you know, you have to, every day if you're awake, you have to bathe,
you
need to shave, you need to brush your teeth, you need to do, you know, cook, change your clothing. All the activities of daily living come to a halt right there if they're sleeping. The second is you don't have to have things to keep yourself busy. There is no need for recreation. You don't have to give this person an exercise machine or TV or something else to keep them busy. Third important component is conflict, interpersonal conflict.
Oh.
If you remember the Biosphere 2 experiments.
Are there women going on this
trip? Hey, no, wait. I am planning my summer vacation road trip with my family right now, and all of a sudden this is starting to make a lot more sense.
The third component is interpersonal conflicts. They are a major issue. If you combine people in a confined space, sooner or later fights erupt. They start getting in each other's space, and you know it becomes a problem, a serious problem. Biosphere 2, that was the number one reason why they just couldn't stand each other, you know, one of the experiments that they had.
Wow.
So I think if they're sleeping, you don't have to deal with all of those issues.
Okay, now tell me this. What is a benefit of going into hibernation? Do you slow down the aging process? Do you slow down your metabolism? What's happening?
The second component, that's the first component was the sleep, and the second component is the hypothermia. With hypothermia, yes. You know, your body metabolic rate comes down. It comes down about 7-8% for each 1 degree drop in body temperature. So if you drop your body temperature, normal body temperature being about 37, if you bring it down to 32, you're right there, you got about 40% reduction in your basal metabolic rate. So you need less oxygen, you need to carry less amount of oxygen, less amount of food. You know, those things are pretty good. In addition to reduction in your oxygen and, you know, metabolic requirements, you also have benefit of hypothermia in terms of reducing the intracranial pressure, which is a major issue.
So that's the pressure inside your brain.
Inside your brain, inside your skull.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major complications is blindness, which apparently happens as a result of optic nerve neuropathy, the compression caused by a rise in intracranial pressure occurring at the point where the optic nerve goes through the hole in the brain to your eyes. So optic nerve neuropathy and blindness can be reduced by reducing the intracranial pressure. So this hypothermia thing has got lots of benefits. As I said, in reduction in oxygen, food, and also reduction in intracranial pressures.
Is it harmful to your body to be in hibernation, to have hypothermia going on, if it's carefully managed?
Again, an excellent question. You know, hypothermia itself we're just starting to understand more about hypothermia. You know, there is lots of unknowns and there's lots of problems with hypothermia. We have tried to keep pigs, for example, hypothermic for a protracted period of time. Two of the major issues with hypothermia are, one is infection. You know, infection because your immune system is suppressed along with the other parts of your body. So infection becomes a major problem. Two is, even though hypothermia causes coagulopathy, you know, blood doesn't clot very well, eventually you start getting DVTs and then pulmonary embolism.
Blood clots. Okay.
That kills the animal. So, you know, if you have difficulty, it rises exponentially. After about 5 or 6 days, at least in the pigs, we see these animals dying as a result of possibly either infection or as a result of deep venous thrombosis. And then ultimately blood clots.
Okay, so now we want to know how you do this. I mean, it seems to me like you're going to have to load an awful lot of ice on that spaceship. I mean, how do you make someone hypothermic?
Excellent question, Tom. You know, we had a fantastic breakthrough study here right in Rochester last summer. I had Dr. Kelly Drew from Arctic Center in Alaska, Fairbanks, along with Dr. Øyvind Toye. That's a Norwegian name. Øyvind, if you're listening, sorry I'm butchering your name, Øyvind Toye. So we came here and we did, for the first time, it's a real breakthrough. We have been able to induce a hibernation-like state in a non-hibernating mammal, such as a pig. The finding is just phenomenal in terms of, until now, we couldn't do it. You know, we cannot induce hibernation in a non-hibernating mammal, such as a pig or a dog. By using certain chemicals, you know, we used N6-CHA, cyclohexyl adenosine, and then using some other chemicals to prevent the side effects of this chemical, we have been able to stop intrinsic thermogenesis and shivering thermogenesis in these animals. Shivering thermogenesis is a major issue.
So tell us what that means.
Every time your core body temperature drops below 36.5 or
centigrade, like most of my life.
Cold all the time.
I'm always cold.
Yeah.
You start shivering, and then there is sympathetic activity that triggers non-shivering thermogenesis. So that's common to all euthermic animals. You know, all
thermogenesis meaning your body tries to warm you up.
Body tries to, warm you up, either by shivering or by production of more intrinsic heat. So we have now a technology to stop that intrinsic fight back that every mammal has. To bring the temperature back to 37. So we have been able to do that for the first time. So we almost have a chemical that can stop the intrinsic fight back or the pushback that the body does. So we can easily induce hypothermia now with these chemicals.
Wow, incredible. So you're working with NASA, is that right?
Yep.
And they're serious about this. They actually want somebody to go, why do we want to go to Mars?
That's the next frontier, Tom. You know, that's human destiny. You know,
exploring.
Exploration is in our blood. You know, NASA has got the timeline. That's, you know, they want to send somebody by 2030 or mid-2030s.
You think they'll make it?
I think they'll make it. I'm excited. I'm completely, totally sold on this. Because in my lifetime, I'm going to see somebody, a fellow human, land on Mars. That's just incredible.
It is incredible. It's how many miles?
Oh, it's got 34.9 million miles, or 35 million miles, so it's pretty far
away. Basically like my summer vacation.
Yeah, 253 days. We could put you into hibernation. It'll be the best trip you've ever had.
Actually, sounds like
slow
a dream.
You're aging, and you know, when you wake up, you'll be right there.
You drive, honey. I'm hibernating.
Hey, it's the Grand Canyon.
Dr. Matthew Kumar, he's an anesthesiologist and an expert on human hibernation and hypothermia. We're glad you're alive and we're glad you're here. Thanks so much for being with us, Tom.
It's awesome. Great to be with you.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll learn the ins and outs of vitamin D. And later on in the program, we'll talk healthy summer grilling options.
Have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or maybe a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. Or send us an email at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Women, listen up. Here's information you need to know about traveling to areas where the Zika virus is known to be present.
The major problem with the Zika is if you get Zika while you're pregnant.
Dr. Mary Jo Kasten explains that mosquitoes transmit the Zika virus.
You might not get sick yourself, but there's a very significant chance that your baby might be born with a small head or have other serious congenital problems.
Dr. Kasten recommends women who are pregnant or who might get pregnant should avoid areas where there are Zika outbreaks. If you have to go to a Zika endemic area, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says women should not get pregnant for
8 weeks after their return.
The other way that Zika can be transmitted is through sex.
The CDC also recommends that if a woman's sex partner travels to an area where there are known cases of Zika, he should not have sex with her without a condom for 6 months after he returns. And in other news, go ahead, pour yourself another cup of coffee. It might just help you live longer. Two studies published in Annals of Internal Medicine show drinking coffee likely benefits your health. One study found coffee drinking is associated with a reduced risk of death from various diseases, and the other study showed drinking a lot of coffee is associated with a lower death risk in African Americans, Japanese Americans, Latinos, and Caucasians. Dr. Donald Hendrud, a Mayo Clinic nutrition expert, says the two studies confirm that coffee can benefit many people who drink it, as long as they don't suffer negative side effects of caffeine. He says there's a common belief that coffee's not healthy, and he adds there are side effects from coffee that may limit consumption in some people, including insomnia, gastroesophageal reflux disease, urinary symptoms, nervousness, and anxiety. That's if you drink too much. But from a health standpoint, he says these two studies are consistent with many other studies that show overall health benefits. There is fairly good evidence that coffee is associated with decreased risk of liver disease and liver cancer, Parkinson's disease, type 2 diabetes, and even improved mood and decreased risk of depression. Dr. Hensrud says that while these new studies are not conclusive, they provide reassurance that if people drink coffee and are not having any side effects, there's little reason to decrease consumption and they should continue to enjoy it. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Tracy, you've seen it, you've heard it. There's so much talk about vitamin D out there. And I guess the first question is, what does vitamin D do? Well, it does several things, and probably the most important is that it helps your body absorb calcium, which your bones need to stay strong. And also, the vitamin D can play a role in your nervous system, your immune system, and your muscle function. So, I mean, it is an important vitamin. And you can get vitamin D in three different ways. You can get it through your skin, you can get it from your diet, or you can get it from supplements, and it sounds like a lot of people are doing that.
Vitamin D is found in a lot of foods, including milk, yogurt, fish, eggs, and my favorite, cod liver oil.
Mm.
The sun also adds to the body's daily production of vitamin D, and as little as 10 minutes of exposure a day is probably enough to keep you from being vitamin D deficient. We know that vitamin D is important to bone health, but there have been other important claims for vitamin D as well. You may have heard it can be used to treat depression or prevent heart disease or even cancer. Here to discuss vitamin D is Mayo Clinic endocrinologist Dr. Sandeep Khosla. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Khosla. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Sandeep, nice to have you here. We really need an expert when it comes to the question about vitamin D. And there are a lot of vitamins that our bodies need. We all know that. But what's so special about vitamin D?
Well, vitamin D has gathered a lot of interest, not only because of its possible effects on bone, as you mentioned, but because of a lot of interest and some evidence that it may actually be important for other things such as immune function, cancer prevention, prevention of heart disease. So I think more so than any other vitamin, it's garnered this interest because in population studies or epidemiological studies, higher levels of vitamin D seem to be protective against many diseases beyond just bone.
Do you believe it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think the evidence from the population studies is certainly suggestive that there's a role for vitamin D, not only in bone, but in other diseases. The problem is that these kinds of observational studies are subject to a lot of potential biases and errors. Mm. So they're useful for generating hypotheses, but those hypotheses need to be tested in rigorous randomized control trials. And so far, the strongest evidence that vitamin D is beneficial is, in fact, for bone and prevention of fractures. Its role in any of the other myriad diseases that it's been associated with in the kind of observational or populational studies still really remains to be established.
So there is no evidence at the present time that vitamin D is good for preventing or treating depression, that it's good for preventing or treating heart disease, or preventing cancer.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Not from rigorous randomized controlled clinical trials, which is the highest bar of evidence that we all want to see before we recommend its use for those kinds of diseases.
And are those studies ongoing? Is that what stage we're at?
Correct. So there are a number of large studies that are ongoing, specifically examining that question.
And are those studies looking to see if excessive doses of vitamin D or just a regular everyday allotment is what is needed?
So that's a good question because, you know, there's a lot of kind of discussion and some confusion about right now what's the best amount of vitamin D to take. And in fact, it's such an important question that the Institute of Medicine actually formed a expert task force to address that question. And in general, their recommendations were that for most people, 600 units, or if you were over the age of 70, 800 units of vitamin D is sufficient. Now, some patients may, you know, especially if they have osteoporosis, we may ask them to take 800 or 1,000 units of vitamin D. More than that probably isn't beneficial and may even be harmful. The safe upper limit that the Institute of Medicine noted was about 4,000 units. There are people out there who are taking even higher levels than that, and that can cause serious side effects. So the studies that are ongoing range from, you know, anywhere from taking 1,000 to 2,000 units of vitamin D, which are still within the safe range. But I think until we know more, for most patients, 800 to 1,000 units is probably a reasonable guideline.
And do you get that from your food? Is that a diet? The diet can provide that, or should people be taking vitamin D supplements?
Unless you like cod liver oil or, you know, certain of the foods that you mentioned, it's actually not that easy to get all your vitamin D just from foods. Sunshine is a good way. Obviously, that has to be balanced against the risk of skin exposure to sunshine and the risk of skin cancers. So for many people, if not most people, some kind of vitamin D supplement is appropriate. And, you know, most multivitamins now have anywhere between 700 and 1,000 units of vitamin D. So in general, if you're taking a multivitamin, that in itself may be enough to get you enough vitamin D.
So if you're outside, outdoors, no matter where you live in the United States, for a period of time during the day, let's say a half hour or an hour, and you eat a normal diet, and you're male, do you need to take a vitamin with vitamin D in it?
Probably not. If you're getting enough sun exposure, as you suggested, that should be sufficient. The problem becomes that particularly in the northern climates where people don't get out in the sun enough, especially in the winter months, it can be a problem. And we've noted, many studies have noted seasonal variations in blood levels of vitamin D, which do tend to go down considerably in the winter months and then come back up in the summer months.
And how about women? When should they start taking a multivitamin or at least vitamin D? And why is that important and more important for women than men?
Yeah, it is more important for women at all stages of life. So, you know, during growth and development, vitamin D is important for boys and girls to absorb calcium and build up the skeleton. During pregnancy, women actually mobilize, especially after delivery when they're breastfeeding, quite a bit of calcium from bone, and it ends up in breast milk. So having enough calcium stores in bone is particularly important even for younger women. And then certainly as women age, the big difference, or one big difference between what happens to women and men, is the presence of the menopause in women, which really is a major insult to the skeleton, if you will, and can cause rapid bone loss. So for those women also, adequate vitamin D is important.
That tricky menopause.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that just a little bit more. So if someone has not taken vitamin D or that's not been a part of their health plan, that's something that they should reconsider as you go through these different stages of life?
Yes, they should. And especially as they approach the menopausal years, I think women should optimize their calcium and the vitamin D intake to make sure that their bones are as well prepared as they can be as they face the advent of estrogen deficiency and the bone loss that happens in all women.
So how do you know if you're getting enough vitamin D?
Well, most people, if they're, you know, taking about 800 to 1,000 units, will have adequate vitamin D levels.
Let's say you're not taking it, but you're concerned, and you're a woman and you're 50. Can you have it checked?
Right. You certainly can have a blood test. It's called the 25-hydroxy vitamin D level, and that's a simple blood draw. It can be measured. And the levels that are considered acceptable vary a little bit depending on who you speak to. The Institute of Medicine recommended a blood level above 20 nanograms per ml, whereas different organizations have suggested an even higher level above 30. My own view is above 20 is probably adequate, and you don't really need to push it to very high levels.
The question that I had originally was, who should be taking a vitamin D supplement? But maybe the better question is there anyone who shouldn't take a vitamin D supplement?
In general, you know, they're safe. I think the only concern might be maybe patients who have a high risk of kidney stones. They may want to be cautious about their calcium and vitamin D intake, because if those patients end up with even a little too much vitamin D, that might increase the amount of calcium that they're absorbing and increase their chances of getting a kidney stone.
All right, now you know the latest scoop on vitamin D from a Mayo Clinic expert, endocrinologist, hormone doctor, Dr. Sandeep Khosla. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Time for a short break, but when we come back, fire up the barbecue.
We'll discuss healthy grilling options with a Mayo Clinic expert.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Well, Tracy, summer means it's time to fire up the backyard grill and enjoy the great outdoors. And most of the time you can do that in Minnesota.
Yes.
And you know, when you're grilling, hamburgers and hot dogs are always popular. And don't forget about the brats.
Right.
But it's not exactly health food.
No, not at all. Here to share some healthy summer grilling hacks.
You mean there are ways to cook on the grill and that are healthy?
Yes, is our executive chef, Jennifer Welper. She is the executive chef with Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program. Welcome back to the program, Jennifer. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your background.
My background is culinary nutrition, so I have kind of the best of both worlds with my culinary degree and nutrition degree.
What is it that made you interested in working with food?
I am a farm girl. Mm-hmm. Grew up with my grandparents and lost my grandpa to heart disease right before I went to college. And he was kind of the glue of the family, and so kind of losing him, it was just like, gosh, you know, if he could have had a little grasp on his diabetes and everything, like we could have had him around for a little bit longer.
That's tough for farmers to do.
It is.
Even though your grandmother, if she was like my grandmother, probably had the biggest garden that you've ever seen.
And she's a great cook.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that we're talking about today. It's how to make your grilling, how to make that a little bit more healthy. Is it even possible?
Absolutely. It's what you pick. I think the big thing that we typically go for our hot dogs and hamburgers and brats is they're always juicy, right? You can't really mess them up, right? Unless they're caught on fire.
Right.
But the big thing is picking your leaner meats and then making sure that you're not overcooking them. So cooking your chicken right to 165, but typically what I advise people is cook it to 160, leave it on the grill, shut the grill off, let it carry over cook. Everything carry over cooks, whether it's a baked potato, it's a muffin, it's a carrot, it's a chicken breast, it's salmon filet, everything continues to cook even though the heat is off.
So why is it wrong to cook it too much?
Because it dries out.
Because it doesn't taste good.
Exactly. And so the other part is when you're looking at something like your leaner proteins, they don't have a lot of fat, right? And so sometimes people want to try to like rush the process, and the little bit of juice that is in them, we try to squeeze it out. So then we have really dry meat. And what do we do with dry meat?
Throw it away usually.
Oh, no.
Some people throw it. Yeah, lots of sauce.
Lots of cheese. You know,
exactly. If you're in my family, it's ranch.
Ranch dressing.
So there's all these other higher caloric things that we do to compensate. And so really what it's about is making sure that we're just cooking it right. You know, we're so afraid of having like raw fish or raw chicken that we usually go maybe like 15 degrees over.
Speaking of chicken, what's your favorite way to grill chicken?
Having a nice lime marinade is always good.
And how long do you have to marinate chicken?
Anytime you have something really acidic, like lime juice, lemon juice, even like white wine, red wine, or something like that, a good 30 minutes is more than enough time, especially if you're working with a lean protein.
Okay.
Because it doesn't have to break down all those other interviscereal tissues because it already is what it is.
Gotcha.
So that's your favorite marinade. What sort of spices do you like to put on chicken?
Garlic, cilantro. I love cumin. I love a little Tabasco. Sometimes just like lemon, salt, pepper. That's always good for me.
Now, are you talking about a whole chicken or pieces or either?
We're looking for the leanest, so that'd be the chicken breast.
She's trying to help us be more healthful. Yeah. Okay, tell me about the vegetables.
The big thing is making sure that you take your vegetables, put them in a bowl, season them in the bowl. So kind of portion out your olive oil and then add your love to it. So onion powder, garlic powder. You can do some of those like Mrs. Dash blends or any of some of those seasoning blends that are low salt. Mix them up and then throw them on the grill. Sometimes even doing a little bit of like a balsamic marinade is nice. Any type of acid works kind of in tandem as adding like a salt flavor. So you can use a lot less salt. So if you're trying to kind of limit the salt intake, lemon juice, any type of acid, white wine, that's actually going to make it taste a little bit more salty.
And since we're putting them on the grill, I mean, if they're big planks of eggplant or something, that'll work. But what are we supposed to use to just get them on the grill? Because a lot of them are too small and they fall through.
Right. So I think the big thing is kind of cut them to what will work on the grill. Otherwise, get one of those cast iron skillets that have the grids in them. That works just as good.
All right, what about grilled pizza? That seems to be pretty popular. Is there a way to make a healthy pizza?
Absolutely. Really? Of course. Yeah, you better believe
it. I don't want to know.
So number one, you want to start with the crust, making sure you have a good like whole wheat crust or maybe a crust that has flaxseed in it. You know, get something really nice and earthy. And then even throwing maybe like a salsa verde or some sort of like nice kind of summery sauce. You can always do marinara as well. And then throw on some grilled vegetables, enhance with maybe some pulled chicken, some pulled pork tenderloin, and then garnish with kind of your fancy cheeses, I like to call. So your blue cheese, your feta, your gorgonzola, your pecorino, and then have just kind of your melty cheese as kind of the sprinkle. So that way it's more of like you've got all of this high density filler, and then you're still having that really good flavor.
You know, you said pulled pork, but you didn't say pepperoni.
You are right. That doesn't mean you can't have it. You know, I usually explain if you want things like pepperoni, you know, take 5 slices, chop it into little pieces, and sprinkle it on. Because if you think about it, you're not trying to have a pepperoni in every bite. You just want to taste it.
Yeah.
So
okay,
maximize your flavor and your calories.
Finally, fish. Ooh. Can you do fish on a grill? And what type of fish should we grill?
You want something that's not really flaky. You know, it'd be really hard to do like cod, but you want to do like a halibut, salmon, of course, shrimp, any type of swordfish, tuna, something that's a little bit more steak-like is a little bit easier unless you have like a plank, like a wood plank that you're going to kind of grill it on. But something to kind of keep in mind is a lot of times when you're grilling, think about this. Maybe you want to grill all week, but you don't actually want to fire up the grill every day. So what you can do is maybe when you're grilling your chicken, grill your salmon as well, but don't grill it all the way. Get those grill marks, pull it off, let it cool, put it in the refrigerator. Tomorrow or the next day, you turn on your oven, you set a timer, and you finish cooking it to your final internal temp. And that's going to be kind of helping you with meal planning and making sure that you're still able to attain those flavors and that health benefit without having to do all that extra work.
All right, quickly before we go, I know that people can come to the Mayo Clinic and actually see all of this firsthand and watch you cook, and you can teach them how to cook healthy. How do they get a hold of you? How do they sign up for a program?
If you go to mayoclinic.org, we have a healthy living program section on there, and you can look for classes for our signature experience or our weight loss programs.
All right, perfect.
That's what you need to do to learn how to grill pizza.
If they take my pepperoni away, I'm not going. Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program Executive Chef Jennifer Welper, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this week.
For more information, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network for today's podcast and previously aired programs.
Tweet us your health and medicine questions anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or email us at mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu. We may answer your question during an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.